Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. It seems like more anti-abortion bills are getting traction in the legislature. The question is, why?
Well, I think we want to be a pro-life state.
Wyoming's population has been decreasing for the past couple of years, but we find there is a population that is growing in Cody.
We do have a lot of people in these roles where women have steady jobs and benefits, and men kind of have a mix of things that keep them going.
Kids can't vote, but they can lobby for policy change.
It makes you feel like you're not just a kid and that you want to actually do something with the community.
We will have those stories and the next edition of StoryCorps from Jackson on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. It's not really that unusual for anti-abortion bills to be considered by the legislature, but they frequently are defeated in committees or don't get much traction. But it appears that may be changing. Wyoming pro-choice supporters were unnerved by the passage of two bills that set certain requirements on doctors 2 years ago. This year, two more anti-abortion bills have passed the House that people have their eyes on. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck has more.
The first bill would require women to wait 48 hours before they have an abortion. Pro-life groups say that other states that have passed such a law have seen a decrease in abortions. Bill sponsor Richard Tass of Buffalo says it's important that women take their time before making such an important decision.
This bill only asks that a woman be given the gift of just 2 days to consider this final act.
He says it's not like buying clothes. It can't be returned. The other bill, sponsored by Scott Clem of Gillette, would require doctors to report when they perform an abortion, and he wants to know the race and marital status of the pregnant woman. Clem, who did not respond to interview requests, has said on the House floor that it's important to know the numbers of abortions and who's getting them so that family planning and education efforts can be targeted towards those individuals. Clem's bill would fine medical providers who don't report such information. Casper Representative Chuck Gray supports this.
The way our reporting statutes are written, they're basically toothless. It's basically very difficult for the Department of Health to know what's going on.
Gray admits there is an overall goal for this type of legislation.
Well, I think we want to be a pro-life state. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's something that we want.
It's not something House Minority Leader Kathy Connolly wants, and in fact, she's annoyed by the legislation.
These bills, honestly, do very little, if anything. We have so few abortion providers in the state. We have so few abortions performed that they are kind of almost irrelevant.
Wyoming healthcare officials are aware of only two doctors who perform abortions in the state, and the numbers of abortions are certainly up for dispute. The Guttmacher Institute says that recent statistics say 120 abortions were provided in Wyoming. The state says it's fewer than five. But it's generally agreed that most women get abortions out of state. Despite the fact that she doesn't think the bills do much, Representative Connolly doesn't like them.
But it is, in fact, chipping away at that kind of fundamental notion of choice and about privacy, about the right of a woman to be able to make choices with her doctor about what to do about reproductive health.
Well, it might seem like we're seeing more bills. Sharon Breitweiser of NARAL Pro-Choice Wyoming says she battles these bills all the time. When she started this work over 25 years ago, Wyoming voters defeated a constitutional amendment to ban abortions. Since then, Breitweiser says abortion has been under attack almost every year.
You know, 2 years ago, everybody suddenly kind of woke up when two bills did pass. It was a bad year, but in some ways it was just that our luck ran out. You know, in years past, it's been good work, it's been good lobbying, it's been people contacting their legislators, but it's also been a little bit of luck, having the right committee chair, running out of time.
House Health and Labor Committee Chairman Sue Wilson of Cheyenne adds that the makeup of the legislature has changed.
You know, I think the interest has always been there, but with the composition of the legislature, there's maybe just been a little bit more of an opening for the bills to make it, forward onto the floor and through the process.
Wilson, who has supported both the 48-hour waiting period and the abortion reporting bill, doesn't know if constituents are more interested in the issue than they have been in the past, but she says for those passionate about it, it's certainly important. By the same token, Breitweiser doesn't think citizen attitudes in Wyoming have changed.
I have no reason to believe that the general public is any less amenable to a woman being able to make those choices and have safe and legal options available to her than they have been in recent years.
Both the 48-hour waiting period and the abortion reporting requirement have moved to the Senate. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
In the early days of psychology, therapists thought mental health disorders were mostly experienced by one gender or the other, anorexia by women, attention deficit disorder by men. But in the last couple of decades, the thinking has swung hard the other way, with attempts to ignore the role of gender in mental health studies. But new research by University of Wyoming psychology professor Cynthia Hartung says it's time to find a middle ground.
What I had noticed in graduate school was that I specialize in attention deficit disorder, which is more common in boys. And so what we were doing is we were mostly doing our research studies with boys. And I thought, well, how are we going to know how to help girls who have this disorder? Because even though it's more common in boys, it still occurs quite frequently in girls. I work a lot with college students who have ADHD, and we're finding that we're diagnosing people for the first time in college, and that girls are much more likely to have been overlooked in elementary school and secondary school. And so we happen to know more about how to treat this disorder in boys. But there are other disorders where it's males that are getting the short end of the stick. So, for example, we know a lot more about how to assess and treat eating disorders in females than we do in males. So I ended up writing an article with one of my professors that was also published in PsychBull. And at the time, what we were focusing on was that we weren't consistently including both males and females in our research studies. So if a disorder was more common in boys, we tended to study it in boys. And if a disorder was more common in girls or women, we tended to study it in women.
And so then it seems like then there was the move towards a more gender-neutral approach to, you know, how we looked at these disorders. And how did that start to affect the treatment of these disorders?
Mm-hmm. So I think what we found in this paper, and we reviewed on 5 years' worth of journal articles to kind of test our hypothesis, and our hypothesis was this gender-neutral one. So the idea now is that if we do a study of ADHD, we include both boys and girls, and basically whoever we can get to be in the study. But we don't consistently analyze our results separately. So we often just say, okay, we had, 20 boys and 10 girls, and here's what we found about how to diagnose and treat this particular disorder. So what's happening is that we're using a treatment that we know works for people in general, but we're not sure how well it works specifically for males and females.
What recommendations would you offer to folks?
Yeah, so we have a lot of recommendations, but a couple of the more pertinent ones. One recommendation is that we get more precise in how we ask our questions. So a lot of times, if I'm doing a research study and I'm interested in whether a certain type of cognitive behavioral therapy works for, let's say, anxiety or depression, that's my primary research question. But what we're recommending is that people be more conscientious about how they're asking the questions, number one. So we often say things like, what is your gender, male or female? And what's being recommended now is that we might say, what is your biological sex, male, female, intersex, not listed, or what is your gender identity, male, female, transgender, not listed. We don't know how a person who's transgender would answer the question, what is your gender, male or female? So right now, what we know about sex and gender differences is confounded, and we need to ask more precise questions. So that's one of our main recommendations, is to be more careful about how we ask the questions. Another recommendation is that it has to do with our statistical analyses, so that we might analyze the data the way that we plan to determine which treatment is most effective. But then, as kind of an afterthought, we could also look at whether or not those findings are equally strong based on people who endorse a biological sex of male and people who endorse a biological sex of female. And that will help us ultimately answer these questions about whether these treatments are equally effective across groups.
Yeah. I wonder if there is any sort of concern or if you guys, as you were kind of putting this all together, how you kind of saw or what you recommended in terms of making sure that there wasn't another swing back in the old direction.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that this, in some ways this is a bit of where we're at now is a bit of a swing, right? Because when I was in graduate school 25 years ago, it was okay to study one sex and not the other. In the last 25 years, it's become it's considered not politically correct to only study one sex over the other. But what we've done is we've kind of decided to ignore sex, and not intentionally, but sometimes we could underestimate the impact that sex might have. Sometimes it turns out that sex is really important. Sometimes it turns out that there are no sex differences. And so, we kind of swung in the direction of let's make sure we're inclusive in our studies, but we probably were entering into it with the hypothesis that there probably aren't sex differences. And so now we're in this place where we just don't know. There may or may not be sex differences. For some of these disorders, we know that, eating disorders are more common in women. ADHD is more common in boys. Learning disorders are more common in boys. So for some of these disorders, we know that there's a differential sex prevalence rate, but we don't necessarily know why. We don't know if there's a biological reason for that or if there's a social cultural reason for that. And so we haven't paid enough attention to it in terms of trying to understand these disorders that do have these differential sex prevalence rates and learning about why is it differentially affecting males and females and does that mean anything for treatment. So we have our work cut out for us in that regard.
Well, thank you so much for coming in and talking to me.
You're welcome.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards speaking with UW psychology professor Cynthia Hartung. She's the co-author of the new study, Sex and Gender in Psychopathology.
When we come back, we'll learn about women breadwinners in Cody. This is Open Space.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. Wyoming's population declined last year while the surrounding state's populations grew. But Cody is an outlier of sorts. In the past decade, there's been an influx of people aged 24 to 34 in Park County. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska reports a portion of these women are providing a steady income and benefits for their families.
And of us in the room, a lot of us are here because of the place. Mm-hmm. The career came second or was an addition or a frosting on top.
That's Amy Quick. She and a couple of other women are sitting around chatting about the dynamic of their relationships. Quick came to Cody for a job at the Shoshone National Forest.
I realized pretty early on that I had the where figured out in life. I knew I wanted to stay here. Took a little bit longer to figure out the other questions.
She eventually met her husband, Andy, who owns a small outdoor recreation store in Cody. The business was his passion, and Amy didn't want him to give it up for the sake of their new family.
I don't think it was a conscious decision that I was going to make the benefits it was just Andy had a kind of a passion for this outdoor recreation business, and it worked out.
Amy found a steady job, and Andy kept his seasonal one running the store. This is not uncommon in Cody. David Bullard is a state economist. He says there are a lot of seasonal jobs in this area.
Yellowstone and Grand Teton Park open for the summer, and so there's a huge amount of seasonal employment there.
Cody has bigger seasonal employment swings than other non-metro Wyoming communities, mainly because it doesn't have a winter economy. So during the winter, Andy works on the business, but also picks up other seasonal jobs like carpentry. The Quicks aren't the only one in this position in Cody. When looking at the numbers, more women are in the labor force in Cody than men, and the industries in which women dominate, like healthcare or education, provide better dependent health insurance. Bullard says that's valuable.
Education and the healthcare really offer a lot of benefits. Some of the seasonal ones like construction and leisure and hospitality tend to offer a lot less.
So for Elizabeth and Carl Hansen, it also made sense for her to provide the steady income and benefits for the family. Carl works a few different jobs and says Elizabeth's job as a teacher gives him freedom.
There's not a lot of health care packages for cabinet makers and carpenters, so or people that work with horses. It's unusual.
And Elizabeth loves teaching. So in her eyes, it's a win-win.
I love school, and I kept going back to school, and now I spend every day at school.
According to Ben Winchester, a rural sociologist for the University of Minnesota, there has been a trend nationally for people in their 30s to move to rural areas.
Quality of life trumps everything here. It trumps a job. Primarily, people are pulled toward a life that they have more control over.
Back at the gathering, the women say they love their jobs and are doubly grateful that those jobs allow their husbands to do what they are passionate about. And Elizabeth says Wyoming, and especially Cody, attracts people with independent spirits and a frontier mentality.
We do have a lot of people in these roles where women have steady jobs and benefits, and men kind of have a mix of things that keep them going.
In the end, it always comes back to their choice to live near the mountains by any means possible.
It's just hard all around.
Yeah. And that builds the common bond, right?
And yet we like it.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kadalska at the Center of the West in Cody.
The Pedigree Stage Stop Sled Dog Race in Jackson is the biggest dog race in the lower 48 states. This year, for the first time ever, women took the event's top three spots. Wyoming Public Radio's Caroline Ballard caught up with the first, second, and third place winners and has that story.
Taking first place in the 2019 race is Annie Mallow, who I caught in a rare patch of cell phone service somewhere in the long stretch between Jackson and the Paw, Manitoba, where she's heading to her next race.
So I'm Annie Mallow from Quebec, Canada. Well, I rush from 95, so it's a very long time ago, and I raced right away with my husband. And we're traveling all the family, so that's a family affair.
Mallow was thrilled to be part of the all-female finish.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're really proud of that, I think. We have a kind of an advantage to be a woman in that race because of the elevation and, you know, the mountains and all that. So usually we're a little bit less heavier than the men. So that's why I think we can perform a little bit more.
Taking second place is Emily Entrekin. I caught her on a rare day off.
My name is Emily Entrekin. I'm from Fairbanks, Alaska. I'm skiing at Big Sky, which is awesome. I'm taking a day off from dogs and having some fun.
Originally, Entrekin wasn't even on the roster for the Stage Stop race.
When I was planning for this race, I was on the wait list for quite a while, but I was still training for it. And I finally got the call that I was in at the end of December. And so I started looking at the roster more, and the more I looked at it, I was like, oh, geez, like the competition is so stellar and great that it was going to be difficult really to get top 10. And I thought if I got top 5, that would be like if everything went perfect and I had a really good luck. And there's, yeah, so second place is really a huge accomplishment and definitely not what I was expecting. Alex and Annie Mallow are like really great competitors and really awesome mushers. And I mean, mostly it just was when I was standing up on the podium with them, like looking around, like, whoa, like my team is competing with these two. So it was really nice to share the podium with them.
Entrekin is also on her way up to Manitoba to compete in the same race as Mallow. And she's betting another person in particular will be feeling the competition. Alex Crittenden, the third place winner, who just missed Entrekin's time at the stage stop race by 11 seconds.
On this race, since it was 8 days and long mile, 11 seconds is definitely very close. Obviously, the team and I ran really well, but I think we had a little extra luck than Alex. And I'm pretty sure Alex is definitely thinking about that every night into the next race. I'm sure she's going to give it her all to make sure she beats me.
My name is Alex Crittenden, and I'm from Bonnerant, Wyoming. Oh my gosh, yeah, 11 seconds. That was tough. I was really, really hoping that I could make up that time on her on the last leg of the race, and we gave it all our all and gave it a really good push, but it just didn't come together. So, but 11 seconds, man, that's pretty much a tie, right? I have had better finishes in other races, but there's no race that compares to this race. Like, the toughness of it and the level of competition is just world class. So there's really nothing that you can compare it to.
The fact that three women placed in the top three spots demonstrates what Crittenden says is one of the great things about the sport.
That's kind of the beauty of dog mushing, is that everybody's equal, you know? I mean, not every team is equal, but each dog driver has their own strengths and weaknesses, and so it doesn't really matter what gender you are, you all compete together. So, and it's kind of the same with the dogs. People always ask me, they're like, oh, is it mostly females? Is it mostly males? And it's like, you know, it's just like people, it depends on the dog. It doesn't depend on the gender for how much drive and effort they're willing to put in. So, but definitely something really cool to be a part of. I am currently in Bozeman, Montana. Sort of lost. I thought I was on the right route and now I'm not. But we're headed for the Paw, Manitoba for a race up there.
With Mallow, Entrekin, and many of the same teams from the stage stop race all heading up to the Trappers Festival in Manitoba, Crittenden is looking forward to a rematch.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. It'll be a really fun race. This is actually my rookie year in this race, and I think she's ran it before, and Annie has as well. And they both, like I said, are amazing dog drivers, and this race will be something new for me. It's going to be quite a bit faster than what I'm used to, so a little bit out of my comfort zone, but I think we'll hang tough. We'll see what happens.
The race begins Thursday. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Caroline Ballard.
When we come back, we'll have stories on how the congressional delegation viewed the president's State of the Union message and the latest on the Colorado River. This is Open Spaces.
You're listening to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. While much of the reaction to President Trump's State of the Union speech fell along party lines, lawmakers from Wyoming are latching on to a few areas where they see common ground. Washington correspondent Matt Laszlo has the story from the Capitol.
The president's address this week included him laying out his vision for U.S. energy policy, which had Wyoming Senator John Barrasso standing and clapping wildly, in part because he was on the GOP leadership team that spent 2 years focused on unwinding basically any regulations they could.
The State of the Union is very strong. We're strong economically, we're strong militarily, and you see it around the world. But I think the president really did focus on energy and the energy dominance now in the United States, so much of it related to our policies.
While many Democrats were upset that the president didn't mention climate change, Rhode Island Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse says he was fine with that omission.
Probably just as well, because if he hadn't mentioned climate change, he probably would have mocked it. But it is a sad state of affairs when a president of the United States won't talk seriously about an issue that concerns at least 70% of the population and is a rising global concern.
On Thursday, White House joined freshman New York Democratic Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to roll out what they're calling the Green New Deal, which is a plan to get the nation completely off of fossil fuels in the future. White House says the reason Trump and Wyoming Republicans aren't focused on combating climate change is for one reason.
There is a mismatch, and the explanation is the role of the fossil fuel industry and its money and threats in the Republican Party.
But Barrasso dismisses those charges and says the president struck the right tone.
Well, it seems the Democrats are going to criticize President Trump almost no matter what he does.
Barrasso spent part of the day after the State of the Union address at the White House for a meeting on energy policy.
As the president said in the State of the Union, we are now a net exporter of energy with crude oil exports as well. So this has really, I think, helped us as a state and as a nation.
Then there was the president's renewed call for a big infrastructure bill, which Democrats have also called for. Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney says much of the president's address focused on areas where the two parties should be able to find common ground.
I thought that it was an excellent speech. I thought he laid out the priorities, areas where we can all work together.
Cheney says the first big test will be whether both sides can work together to avoid another government shutdown. She says the outcome will be telling on what's in store for the next 2 years.
We'll see what happens. I think that what's going on right now in terms of immigration and whether or not we can get funding for border security is a really important test case.
The president's call for unity didn't find a sympathetic audience in Delaware Democratic Senator Chris Coons.
It was a slap in the face with an olive branch.
Many Democrats were offended that Trump used the address to double down on his wall and that he focused on other divisive issues like abortion. But the president did lay out a new proposal to defeat AIDS in America, while also calling to combat childhood cancer. Both goals won broad bipartisan standing ovations. Still, Coons is waiting for Trump to flesh out his ideas.
In a number of passages, the president made some bold proposals, but with absolutely no details.
Those criticisms make Republicans like Cheney bristle, and she says Democrats have to learn to compromise with Trump.
So I think what the president did was he said, look, here's what I'd like to do. I'd like us all to work together. I think it's important to move past partisanship. But, you know, it takes two parties to do that.
Now that the speech is over, Congress and the president have less than 2 weeks to fund the government and avert another shutdown. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
States that rely on the Colorado River for their water supplies are struggling to finish a plan that would keep its biggest reservoirs, Lake Mead and Lake Powell, from dropping. Five states are done, but California and Arizona failed to meet a January 31st federal deadline. Luke Runyon from KUNC in Colorado and Brett Jaspers from KJZZ in Arizona have more on what this all means.
The Colorado River is stressed. Simply put, states are using too much of it. Plus, long-term drought means supplies and demands aren't matching up. Brett, the drought contingency plan is meant to rein in water use and keep the whole system from crashing.
Right. It's been in the works for more than 3 years. Everyone who uses the river was supposed to be in agreement by now.
But Arizona missed the deadline.
Well, yes, but a lot did get done, including two important water bills making it through the legislature. And negotiations finally brought in some groups that hadn't been included in the past, like the Colorado River Indian Tribes based in western Arizona. Chairman Dennis Patch thanked those who worked with them.
This is our first run on that, and we were very confused, and we're a lot smarter now. We hope to continue to work with the state on all water issues that come up.
The Colorado River Indian Tribes are going to take some land out of production and leave the saved water in Lake Mead.
So while Arizona was celebrating its big milestone, the federal government came in and crashed the party.
Yeah, the Fed said the state didn't do enough for the deal to be considered done.
Same story in California, specifically the Imperial Irrigation District, the single largest user of the Colorado River. They won't sign the deal until they get more federal money to manage the decline of the Salton Sea, a huge lake that's causing environmental and public health problems as it shrinks.
Everyone seems to agree that states need to use less water from the river, but when it comes down to who actually uses less, that's when the tension starts to rise.
Exactly. I heard the same thing from John Berggren. He's a policy analyst with Western Resource Advocates.
This is where you really run into winners and losers and fundamentally changing who the current winners and losers are, which anytime you talk about changing that, people are going to put up a stink and put up a fight.
So that's one reason it's been so difficult.
It's also worth noting that these deals won't be in place for very long, maybe 6 years, tops.
And that's been a big source of criticism, that the deal doesn't go far enough to solve the region's big water problems.
You can even see that in the name of the deal, the Drought Contingency Plan. It seems to suggest we're dealing with a temporary dry period rather than an overall shift in climate.
John McLeod is an alternate commissioner on the Upper Colorado River Commission.
Most of the policymakers in the West are persuaded that we have aridification rather than drought. In other words, drought assumes that it will change. And many folks now are saying, this is it. This is what we can expect.
For now, that shift is just in the attitude of leaders and isn't taking center stage in water policy.
So drought, climate change, and don't forget overallocation. Those are huge things that will need to be tackled next time.
Yep, McLeod says as soon as water managers wrap up these drought contingency plans, which, by the way, still need approval by Congress and the president, they immediately have to take on a new set of even harder negotiations.
Because both basins have ideas about things that need to be fixed, and they're not compatible in some cases. So it's going to be a difficult negotiation. It was a difficult negotiation the first time.
Those talks are supposed to render a long-term solution, but the weather in the near term adds a big degree of uncertainty, too. Right now, many streams in the basin are projected to have less than average flows throughout this spring and summer.
And that could end up adding even more pressure to the river and the people in charge of managing it. I'm Brett Jaspers in Arizona.
And I'm Luke Runyon in Colorado.
This story is part of Elemental, covering sustainability, a multimedia collaboration between public radio and TV stations in the West, and part of the ongoing Colorado River coverage in partnership with KUNC in Colorado, and supported by a Walton Family Foundation grant.
Over the last 2 years, the Interior Department has been dealing with a lot of public requests from media outlets and environmental protection groups. In fact, it says requests have spiked about 30%. The agency says it's swamped. So it's proposed a new policy, and depending on who you talk to, the change will either make it easier to get information to the public or a lot more difficult. Our reporter Nate Hedgie tried to find the answer.
Earlier this year, Ryan Zinke resigned from his post running the Interior Department. Zinke's resignation came after more than a dozen ethics investigations were launched against him. Here he is on Fox News in late November.
This is politically motivated. In Montana, we call it BS.
Many of those investigations were spurred by public records requests over everything from Zinke's travel records to a real estate deal in his hometown in Montana. One of the environmental groups filing those requests was the Western Values Project. Zinke called them out specifically during his Fox News interview in November.
They're operatives from the Democratic Party. They're hacks. They've always been. And they need to be investigated.
Western Values Project is based in Zinke's home state of Montana. It's actually a nonprofit group that advocates for public lands. It's been a vocal critic of the Interior Department, and it's filed more than 150 big public records requests. So the question is, are conservation groups like this causing a massive backlog at the agency? The Interior Department won't name names, but it does say it's been inundated by a lot of big, broad public records requests.
A range of information.
Hubble Relat, Interior's top lawyer.
That appears to, at times, be asking for every document that's ever been created by the Department of the Interior.
Relat says to add salt to the wound, if these big requests aren't acknowledged in 20 business days, the department can be sued. This, he says, slows down the processing of public records requests for everyone else.
John Q. Public, who's submitted a request for information, who doesn't have the ability to pay a lawyer to bring a lawsuit, has to wait in line even longer.
This is why the Interior Department says it's proposed a new rule that gives the agency greater discretion over how it handles requests, including a monthly cap on the number of records it processes for individuals or organizations.
What this does is allow us to say, okay, we will produce a set number of documents, and then we're going to move to the next requester, and then and on and on, so everyone gets the same amount of documents, and we will return to your request once everybody has had a turn.
The agency says the changes are in response to big requests from, quote, litigious special interest groups. How do you define, what is a litigious special interest group?
Well, our FOIA logs are public. So, you know, I think anyone can go through and look at who's requested on a consistent basis information, you know, from all the different bureaus that we have. So I guess I'll leave it at that.
I followed Hubble's advice and checked the FOIA logs. They show that some of the top requesters include environmental group, the Center for Biological Diversity, media outlets Politico and the environmental news service EE News, and that environmental group Ryan Zinke doesn't care for, Western Values Project. Chris Sager is that group's executive director. He's not buying the agency's reason for the proposed changes.
What they are doing is a very thinly veiled effort to target critics of the Trump administration and to keep their corruption a secret.
Sager acknowledges that Western Values Project has filed a lot of requests and has sued the Interior Department when it didn't get the records back to them in time. But he says it's the agency's job to respond to the public's needs, not the other way around.
In reality, they should be thinking of ways to be even more transparent and even more publicly accountable.
Sager says if the Interior Department wants to reduce its backlog, it should hire more staff to process requests. He points to a 2018 report from the agency's chief FOIA officer. That report acknowledged a big rise in complex requests and subsequent litigation, but Sager says it also acknowledged this.
They are understaffed, and the leadership there has not responded by providing them with the resources they need to adequately do their job.
Sager isn't the only one concerned about the Interior Department's new rule. House Democrats have called for an oversight hearing, and environmental protection groups say they are prepared to litigate if the changes move forward. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Nate Hedgie in Salt Lake City, Utah.
Up next, Tennessee Watson joins some students lobbying the legislature and StoryCorps from Jackson. This is Open Spaces.
You are enjoying Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. This session, Wyoming lawmakers killed two different bills that would have made the U.S. citizenship test a high school graduation requirement. Superintendent of Public Instruction Jillian Balow pushed the idea as a way to strengthen civics education across the state. Critics argued that rather than more exams, kids need more opportunities to experience democracy in action. Wyoming Public Radio's education reporter Tennessee Watson checked out a project that gives kids a chance to advocate for policy change. Here's an audio postcard from a day at the state legislature with the Laramie Youth Council.
Senator Rothfuss.
Mr. President, may I have the privilege of the floor, please? The
floor is yours, Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I would like the Senate to welcome some excellent students from back across the hill in Albany County, go to Laramie High School, that are members of the Laramie Youth Council. They are here to learn more about the process and to engage the legislature on a piece of legislation that we've worked over the next few days.
Wyoming is one of just a few states that requires juvenile offenders to petition to have their records expunged. And the Laramie Youth Council wants that to change.
Thank you. Welcome. I hope you enjoy your day in the Senate. And as far as your lobbying efforts, bring it on.
Senate President Drew Perkins might have been joking, but the 14 Laramie High School students who made the trek over to Cheyenne are on a mission to get House Bill 44 passed. Today, their focus is securing support in the Senate. Step one, get approval from the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Madam Chair, members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, my name is Ruby Novogradsky.
Ruby Novogradsky starts off the group's public testimony explaining that the expungement process is complicated, especially for kids from families who can't afford to hire a lawyer.
And so they believe that on the completion of their diversion program, their records are automatically expunged, but that's not how it works in Wyoming. That is how it works in a lot of other states.
And Ruby says that sends a message to kids in Wyoming that the state doesn't care about their future. Sam Miller then takes over. He's heard concern from senators who see the proposed changes to the expungement process as too lenient on juvenile offenders.
I'd like to reiterate that this is not the case. Though the district attorney can file on behalf of the individual, there's still a 20-day waiting period where objections can be filed. So this still makes it so that youth are going to be interested in trying to reform themselves for society.
Will Daly Green closes it out with some humor.
I think the biggest problem is that, frankly, kids are morons.
He explains how a stereotypical lack of follow-through can have dire consequences down the road. Even a misdemeanor on a juvenile record can make it hard to get a job as an adult.
Thank you so much. For an additional public comment.
Senate Judiciary Chair Tara Nethercott closes public comment and calls for a vote.
Aye.
The bill passes committee, but for Ruby, the big victory is being taken seriously.
It was amazing to see the Senate Judiciary Committee say thank you for coming. We appreciate your testimony because it makes you feel like you're not just a kid and that you want to actually do something with the community.
That's how you get young people hooked on civics, says Sam.
If you go and watch it happen when you're 16, you're going to be more likely to want to participate in it when you're 40 and more likely to want to maybe run for a state senate or city council or be more civically engaged.
Sam says getting to know the procedures makes the process less intimidating and more fun.
He looks kind of familiar.
He's got a big mustache.
I'm pretty sure we didn't talk.
Layla Johnson is keeping track of how the group thinks the senators will vote. Next to the 30 names is a yes, no, or maybe. In the lobby of the Senate, while bills are being debated on the floor, Banaz Wadi and Caitlin Wong pull Cheyenne Senator Stephen Pappas aside to find out where he stands.
Typically, I have not told anybody how I'm going to vote on a particular bill because I reserve the right to change my mind after I hear the debate. But I can tell you I'm inclined to support the bill.
The goal is to pull a total of 16 senators off the floor. But when the bus rolls up at noon, they're one senator shy of their goal. But it's time to go back to school. Sam does have a test to take, but he toys with asking his mom to drive over from Laramie to pick him up so he can stay longer.
Even though it's difficult to take a day off from school, I think the benefit of coming and seeing the process outweighs that consequence.
Turns out the students on the Laramie Youth Council aren't the only ones who want in on the political process. That day, Shoshone High School students came down to support career and technical education, and students from Pathfinder High School in Lander lobbied to support a new state amphibian. As we head to the bus, Laramie Youth Council member George Yost says he's impressed by how open and accessible Wyoming lawmakers are. He's given the day a 9 out of 10.
Like 10 out of 10 would have been if they let us in the Senate break room. Bye.
But the one thing that was off limits were the snacks in the Senate break room. To get at those, he'll have to get elected. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Tennessee Watson. Thank you.
Jackson is the most economically unequal city in the U.S. That's according to the Economic Policy Institute, a nonpartisan think tank. A study found in 2016 that the income gap between the bottom 99% and the top 1% is the widest in Jackson. And that makes affordable housing challenging. When StoryCorps came to Jackson in June, friends Marcella Badillo and Christina Briones sat down to talk about what that means for immigrant families.
3 years ago, I lost my house, and also I have four kids, and I'm a single mother, and I ended up living in a shelter here because I couldn't find a place to live. Yeah, and I really don't know. Because
it's just hard. I mean, yeah.
But not impossible.
Not impossible, yeah. I get my GED.
Good.
And I get a better job. But housing is still hard. I mean, even if you have if you study, if you have an education, you educate yourself more. And I mean, housing is the big problem. It's hard.
Really hard. And I really don't know what we can do.
As Latinos, we come from other culture. Mexico is different. Here's different. So there's different rights, and they don't know what are our rights and what kind of resources we can have here. So
yes, but I know, I understand that our organizations are working hard to provide affordable housing for families, but I've been noticing that there's not enough.
Yeah, it's hard to qualify because of their status.
Yeah. So if you don't have documents, you don't qualify.
As you say, it's not really easy to have our own home, especially because rents are very, very high. I mean, $2,800 a month, $3,000 a month, that's ridiculous
for a house
to rent.
Yeah.
Especially when you have kids. Some places don't accept kids. They prefer...
Dogs are pet instead of kids,
it's hard because they say, oh, if you have children, sorry, we cannot rent.
And that's discrimination, right?
Yeah, that's discrimination. And also that happened with me when I was pregnant on my third child. My other kids used to be in Mexico. And because I was pregnant, that guy said, oh, you are pregnant. I don't think we can rent a room for you because we don't accept kids.
Kids. They need stability.
Place to live, a safe place to live.
A place where they can call it home and feel safe and feel secure and feel they can develop in a safe environment and everything. After living in Jackson for 10 years, I moved back to Mexico and I didn't like it.
No, I went to Mexico.
When I got to Mexico, it was my town. Hometown, but I got there and I was like, what I'm doing here? This is horrible. I miss Jackson.
Yeah.
And I came back. I was like,
oh, I'm at home.
Yeah, this is home.
I don't want to leave Jackson because this community makes me feel safe. This community makes me feel I am in home.
Yeah.
Because I've been here for almost 16 years, almost half of my life living here. I mean, I am from Mexico, but I know more United States. I know more Jackson.
Friends Marcella Badillo and Christina Briones talking at StoryCorps in Jackson. Taylor Stagner produced that piece. Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. If you missed part of the program or want to hear it again, you can find it on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. You can hear old shows, sign up for our podcast, and even check out other podcasts. Anna Rader is our web editor.
You can support this show, our coverage of the legislature and other topics, by making a pledge on that website. Just click the Pledge Now button.
We always enjoy hearing about good ideas for future stories and interviews. You can send those to us through that website. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.